Hey, Meg and Dr. G here for SPKN, and today we are joined by Dr. Michael Cottingham and Chris Waddell. Michael is an associate professor of sport administration in the Department of Health and Human Performance at University of Houston. His research interests focus on perceptions of athletes with disabilities, as well as spectatorship and sponsorship in disability sport. In addition, he is the director of Adaptive Athletics at the University of Houston. Chris Waddell is the most decorated male monoskier in U.S. history. Waddell was a skier at Middlebury College before a skiing accident left him paralyzed from the waist down. Competing in his first Paralympic Games at France in 1992, Waddell took home two silver medals in slalom and giant slalom. His new documentary film called One Revolution tells of his dramatic story in 2009 to Tanzania and up the 19,340-foot Kilimanjaro mountain. His goal was to become the first paraplegic to summit Mount Kilimanjaro, unassisted on a hand cycle. We look forward to speaking with both these gentlemen. Michael, Chris, welcome to SPKN.
So Chris, why don't you start? I want you to tell me your secret because, I mean, you're an award-winning skier at Middlebury College in Vermont and you're skiing down the hill and basically you just lost a ski.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's one of those things you can't plan for, right? I mean, it's just a random kind of thing, something I've done over and over and over again in my life. And probably was a fairly, you know, innocuous, benign looking fall. I don't remember any of it. And yeah, just hit the ground and broke a couple of vertebrae and life took a divergent turn.
And I've lost a ski several times. I've fallen on a cat track and you don't know how hard those are. Those are really hard.
Yes.
But that was amazing to me. But so you're back in school on a mono ski competing in a year?
So yeah, so I went back to school. It's funny, things have changed a lot now, right? I was in the hospital for 2 months then, which was a short period of time. I think people with this kind of an injury are in the hospital for like 2 weeks now, which I have no idea how they manage that. But I left the hospital on Friday and I returned to Middlebury, to, you know, an almost 200-year-old school built on the top of a hill in Vermont in the middle of February. And in a wheelchair. And yeah, that was it. And then started skiing 362 days after the accident, which is a little bit deceiving because I actually started falling in a mono ski 362 days. It took a little while to get to the skiing part of it.
Yeah. Well, Middlebury is not flat.
No.
So you have the snow and I'm sure it was not easy getting around.
It was not easy. It's funny. I was just talking with a friend of mine, actually my roommate from college. He had just moved to Park City, which is where I live. And we were getting into his new like rental house before they get their actual house. And we were kind of having to go around the back. And I said, you know, back in Middlebury, I remember being in my room and trying to map out where I was going to go because there could be a hill, there could be a flight of stairs, stuff that I'd never even considered before. But before I left, I was like, okay, I should be good. I'm okay. I can get there without necessarily having to call somebody and say, will you come with me? Because some of those hills, especially when I first started, I couldn't make it up those hills.
That's amazing. Yeah. Now, I would say that's inspirational, but I know Michael has something to say about that.
Well, I would say that the term inspirational is maybe misplaced a lot. I think when you look at the definition of the word inspiration, what an individual is saying is what the actual definition is, it's an external experience which someone internalizes and makes them live life in a different way. And when people describe disability, they'll often say the term inspiration, but what they really mean is something very different. So I can tell a bit about what we know that they mean and what we think, right? So what our research has been able to determine is when someone says that's inspirational, what it really means is, I expected you to do very little and you did better than I expected, right? So it's sort of a backhanded compliment. If you see an elite athlete without a disability communicating, no one looks at Steph Curry and says he's inspirational. He may be athletic, he may be dynamic, he may be a streaky shooter, maybe whatever. but they don't typically use the term inspiration. The term inspiration gets used in the context of disability because the focus becomes on the viewer, not the individual who's doing the act, right? So when Chris was competing as an elite skier, he wasn't doing it to make you feel better about yourself. He was doing it to compete, right? He was doing it to train, to compete, to win, probably the same reasons he was doing it before his accident, maybe to challenge himself and to push past barriers, but it wasn't about you, right? And so when we think about inspiration, I think it's a really common mistake to use that term in the context of disability, because it really is about the individual who's competing or who's engaging, and not about the way that it makes people who maybe don't have disabilities feel. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And you, Michael, you're still competing in sports that.
No? No, I retired many, many years ago. Strictly an academic these days. Okay. A lifetime ago, competed at the collegiate level in wheelchair tennis and basketball, and coached internationally for some time, and then went the route of academia. So, yeah, it's been probably 20 years since I actually competed. But I literally love the study side of it. It's been so fun. We run a lot of programs. So to me, the administrative and managerial side is really where I was always attracted to.
Well, if you're anything like Brian, you are competitive in the academic world.
Chris, what do you think too? I mean, because you're a keynote speaker too, and you've written about this sort of thing too. I mean, how do you feel too, or about the inspirational kind of use of that term, as well as just trying to, I think, you know, what I get from reviewing some of your work is encouraging people to try to be, you know, active and fit and strong, but also, you know, realizing, like you earlier, you mentioned having to navigate life differently because the built environment and the social structures are not designed really for accessibility often.
Inspirational is a really interesting and charged word, I think, especially within our context. And charged, I mean charged, really charged, in that I've seen people almost come to blows over the term inspirational. I remember being with a bunch of the buddies of mine that I was skiing with, and we went out one time in Park City, and some guy came over, oh, it's so great that you guys are here. And he's like, don't say it, don't say it. And the guy's like, no, it's so inspirational. And it literally escalated. Wow. Which can be hard. You know, I think that you know, Michael was talking about that it's a variety of different things. It's perception from one side and the other. One, I think that we're all looking for inspiration. So I don't think it ever should really be an insult in any way to say, oh, you're inspirational. You know, you're pushing me to do something more than I might do. Hey, that's good. I think in some ways, Steph Curry is sort of an example too. You look at sort of a smaller, skinny guy and you go, okay, that's kind of inspirational. You know, I mean, somebody who's doing more with less is most assuredly inspirational. To me, it's the two-dimensional part, right? The two-dimensional part is the only category that you can fit into. Is being inspirational, because the opposite is you're doing nothing. So to Michael's point, if you're doing something, that's inspirational. And I don't want to lose the sense of inspiration. I mean, like, you know, I mean, just remember like tying your shoes for the first time or something like that. Like any kind of a personal breakthrough is something that's entirely inspirational. And we need help with that. I mean, I feel like nobody has a corner on the market on inspiration by any means. And, you know, I collect heroes, and, you know, and I don't know, I might be greedy in that sense, but I'm constantly looking at people who inspire me or push me to go further. So I would never want to consider it an insult, but at the same time, I wouldn't want it just to be when it is that two-dimensional part of like pat on the back, hey, good for you. You know, like that's a problem.
And if I can just add to that, I think the biggest thing you have to consider is genuine respect for what something is accomplishing, right? It's not inspirational that Chris gets out of bed, right? It's not inspirational that I am breathing, right? I mean, he has legitimate successes and I have legitimate successes, and those should be honored and respected, just like everyone on this call has legitimate professional and personal successes. The problem is the expectation level is often so low that anything that gets completed is inspirational. If you say, wow, he's really inspirational, well, what were his times? Let's honor that. Let's honor his records. Let's talk about who he beat or how he beat them or what those performances look like, instead of just saying, man, he's a guy in a wheelchair that did this thing. How about we acknowledge what that legitimately meant and who he beat or what that accomplishment means in a context, right? And giving it some depth, as he was referring to. I think that's an okay place to go, rather than sort of a rather lazy approach to just saying, you know, wow, this is cool. And then sort of looking at it and feeling good about yourself and then walking off. Like that's the problem.
Well, it certainly relates to some of the other literature too on women's sports in the sense of, right, women don't want to be just a sexual object or just a token. They want to be acknowledged for being very good athletes in their performance as well. So I pick up that similar kind of discourse or way of understanding this too.
Yeah, and really in a lot of ways, I mean, it is about perfecting your craft, right? Mm-hmm. And it's interesting talking about having been an athlete and then moving into academia, where you're never really done, right? In either profession, you're constantly trying to get better and better. And to me, that's the human journey. And the human journey, the funny part about it, and I think where some people need inspiration, is there are a fair number of pit stops along the way in this human journey of like, I'm tired of perfecting my craft. I want to sit around for a little while. And I think that's where looking around and seeing other people and go, oh yeah, I should really get going on what I'm trying to do, what I said I was going to do.
That's what I did, Chris. When I saw you climbing Mount Kilimanjaro, I was like, I need to get out of this chair and I need to start like hiking. I need to get outside. I've been in front of my computer way too long. That was amazing.
Let's pause and talk about the ableism language that Meg just used for a second.
Uh-oh. What did I do?
This is actually a very sort of complex and interesting example. And I hate to call you out on me, but, and you know, probably yell at me later. But, right, especially in this context, right, people will say things like metaphorically, like, I need to get out of my chair.
Yeah. After I said it, I was like, oh.
Yeah, right. We step in it. And then, especially in this case, right, Chris is, I'm going to say, hiking in a chair or wheeling up in the chair that on Mount Kilimanjaro too. I mean, it's impressive to do it, but I saw the picture too, and I'm thinking about this thing and hearing the language too, and just want to stop and point it out and then, you know, invite dialogue on it and then going, you know, shoot. I mean, you did this thing too in the chair, which is remarkable too, right? I mean, just hiking to the top of these things in Colorado here are 14,000 feet, but anybody climbing a mountain, let alone doing it in a chair, I think it's got to be even tougher, I would imagine. I don't know. So,
but that's... Chris, you know, I didn't mean, no. Yeah, I was actually in a chair sitting at my computer.
You just stay in the chair.
Is that not?
You know, it's an interesting thing. I think that for me, one of the things that gets difficult is when we start splitting hairs so much that we're hesitant to have a conversation for worry about insulting someone.
Yep.
And I'm going to bring this back to the mountain. And the beauty of the mountain is that we are all climbing a mountain, whether it's literal, whether it's proverbial, we are all climbing a mountain. And that has to get to the universal. I think that one of the things that I try to do is approach my stuff with as universal a message as possible, because I don't want to make anybody wrong. Because if I make somebody wrong, the risk is that they will harbor a resentment. And even if they're educated, they won't necessarily adopt it, or they will be separate. And being separate means that we're not sharing that experience. And the reason why I climbed Kilimanjaro is that we can relate to that experience. In some ways, being a Paralympic athlete is an experience that people can watch on television, but sometimes it's a context that is a challenge to understand. You can understand it in a sports context in that, you know, person A is beating person B. But in terms of a relation context, it can get a little bit harder, where I think that the mountain in some ways was an easier concept for people to wrap their mind around, the idea of man or woman versus, and see, now I've just stepped in it to a certain extent, right? So we can put all of the pronouns in and say whoever, man, he, she, you know, they, whatever.
are climbing a mountain where we all are, you know. And I think that sometimes that's the challenge, is we can make it more difficult for us to connect as people. And, you know, that stumbling block's a challenge, I think.
That's one of the reasons we're doing these interviews and getting as much communication going as possible, is that there's so many rules and there's so many ways in which we worry we're going to step in it, you know, for a lack of a better word, way to phrase it. But, you know, we don't want to stop talking. We don't want to stop talking about what's going on in the world. And so it's better to step in it and go, oh, I stepped in it, and let's, you know, let's figure out the best way to go about this moving forward. But I think we definitely need to keep having the conversations.
Absolutely. And I would just say, I mean, it was a tremendous feat what Chris did to go up the mountain. I mean, part of it is that I think the best way that we can sort of really be inspired by people and really be honor their what they accomplished, their accomplishments, is to take a little time to understand, like, what does that really mean? Chris, what's your injury level? Do you mind me asking?
T1011.
Okay. So he has like limited trunk control. So like that's a whole nother, like he has not full trunk control. It's a whole nother level of pushing up that hill than just if you guys were in a chair pushing up that hill, right? There's considerations there, right? There's considerations of like spasticity and what, there's just things to understand. And for individuals that put in a little time to understand and can really appreciate that, I think it's the best way to honor a success. I mean, we have folks who come out and they play wheelchair tennis recreationally in our program every week. And they're living life and they're independent. I'm not sure they're inspirational any more than you guys joining your leagues are inspirational, but I think they're actively living life and they're getting a lot out of that, and that's beneficial. And then we have individuals who have more ambitious goals in terms of the competition side of things. And, you know, their pathway and the way that inspires you may be very different. But I think oftentimes the accomplishments of people with disabilities get lumped together as wow, when you really need to acknowledge some of those things are much more wow than other things, which are great. That's cool things to do, but it's probably not that much different than you guys going out or you guys, you know, doing anything or anybody doing anything. Does that make sense? Like, I mean, would you feel uncomfortable if you went to go play pick up basketball in your neighborhood and someone came up to you and went, wow, I'm so inspired that you're out here. You would look at them like, I'm just playing basketball, right? I sometimes think that kind of all these things get lumped together inappropriately.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, as an analytic point, right, you can pause and go, right, think about the language that we use to understand the world. And in different contexts, using the word inspiration is not going to mean the same thing. I mean, you point out just in a totally different context, it's kind of silly. And so, right, should we be talking about it? Or when we only talk about people with disabilities or people in chairs, or people with varying abilities in a particular light, it paints them as unidimensional, and it doesn't allow for really multiplicities or multiple kind of identities, practices, a more complex, rich understanding that's more accurate.
To be a human being. Yeah. But I think, you know, I think there's a part of it too. I mean, think about what we're drawn to in terms of, especially like the world of sport. We're so drawn to the underdog, right? I mean, you hear the Cinderella story, like when you're talking about the Final Four, you know, that's, I mean, Rudy, right? You know, these kinds of things, like we're drawn to it. And I think that there's a part of that as human beings, there's a voyeurism part of it of like, wow. And then there's the question of how did you do what you did? And the question, how did you do what you did, should be informational, informative for me, right? I mean, that's the intention. And if there's a give and take, I think that's it. And if you're allowed to be a rounded character who is not just inspirational, but also flawed and, you know, a variety of other things, like, hey, you can actually be human. It's like, yep, fairly human most days.
This takes us into the part of the show where we're going to talk about both of your flaws.
So there's a longer part of the show.
Yeah, we have time, yeah.
Part 17. Nope. So I get to Michael, I mean your research too looks at marketing, and this is partly how we, you know, we know each other through marketing and sport management world and coaching world. You know, what's the state of the sport marketing of adaptive athletics or Paralympic sports? And right, we know that they do draw upon the inspirational narrative, but what do we know about that? And what's the critique of that too?
Well, let's start with the really good news, which is it's never been better. And I mean that. So I will say that what we've seen is a genuine effort by corporate partners who've invested in diversity, equity, inclusion in some useful ways that have not only actively included disability in that discussion, but done it in a way that's respectful to the athletes in large measure and been really important and been really positive and have used individuals with disabilities to consult on these issues. And I think that's really valuable. If you were to look at how disability is seen and how people are hooked on it, that inspirational narrative of, wow, this is so amazing, wow, that's so cool, the research shows this is the best way to hook people quickly. But if you don't immediately transition to sort of a focus on the accomplishments, the athleticism, the having a rooting interest, then you really quickly lose some people. And there's some really fascinating research that talks about that. I've always said that you'll know when disability sports really made it when people are willing to boo a poor performance, right? That's when you're like, oh, we're there. When people were like, man, you were horrible today. That will be a big step for us as a society.
Chris perked up too when you said it. Can you guys say a little bit more about that one too? Like, I'm thinking about that now too. Like, all right, well, that's heavy, man. Wait, booing adaptive or people in chairs or other Paralympic athletes, like, wow. Yeah.
Do you want to go into that, Chris, or do you want
me to? I mean, I'm happy to add a little bit to what you said. Yeah, I mean, booing, and you know, part of it is you're actually allowed. It makes it real if you're allowed to root against someone. Yeah. I mean, I'm from Massachusetts, right? And it's not a great thing to say at the moment because we just finished last. But I am a Red Sox fan, and I'm happy to root against the Yankees. You know, I'm a Red Sox fan and a fan of anybody playing the Yankees, really is what it comes down to. There's something to be said for that, for a hometown kind of thing. And it's interesting because I think early on there was an emphasis to promote the games as the games. And I think every league has gone through this where no player is any bigger than the league. And they've all found out that it's exactly the opposite, right? I mean, you have your Michael Jordans, you have your breakout athletes. And certainly that on the Paralympic side is what's going to, you know, I mean, sort of the Tiger Woods kind of phenomenon where, you know, it raises all boats, right? I mean, this is it where there's a greater sense of fandom, but it's also a hometown feeling that you have your team, and it's okay if you have your team and you're rooting against the other team. I mean, it's kind of like we're legit because it happens everywhere else. This is not the kid gloves kind of deal where it's like, oh, no, we have to root for everybody because it's all well and good and it's nice and they're all winners. It's like, no, the biggest winner is the person who worked the hardest and performed the best on that day. It's sport.
Can I share a study? When it's really boring, you guys just cut it out because you guys have editing tools, right? We did a study where I really wanted to look at how people perceived the inspirational mantras, right? So we had a person who was sitting in a wheelchair who played table tennis, and we just talked about how great of a table tennis player they were. We had an audio overlay, right? And then we had a second video with a person standing, and we had that person, we had them a backstory. I think their parents had died and they were poor and they had been through all this trauma and horribleness. And they were like a really bad athlete that worked hard and become a world champion. We gave them this amazing backstory. And then we measured who they felt was more inspirational. And they absolutely were like, oh, the guy in the wheelchair, right? Well, and, you know, people saw either one or the other, and it was always the guy in the wheelchair, right? And then when we actually put like an overlay of like how he overcame his disability, man, it popped off through the roof. Because that's what people expected to hear. Our expectations of, again, who knows if that person had a hard life? Maybe that guy had an exceptionally easy life, right? Maybe that person didn't overcome a lot. Maybe they did. But we have some inherent presumptions about the overcoming. And I think what I guess I would ask people to realize is the research shows that for most people, the greatest barriers are not the physical barriers anymore. Those still matter, right? Like the getting on public transportation and transporting your chairs or loading your chairs in your vehicles or going to a facility that doesn't have bathroom accommodation, those are still realities, although substantially better than they've ever been in history. But it's the social barriers, it's the expectations, it's the struggling to get a sponsor who's going to actually recognize you as an athlete. It's the going to the gym and everyone wanting to take videos of you when you're just trying to get a workout, right? It's those sort of things that actually wear on people, and they do a lot more emotional damage than just the physical barriers around them, right? Because again, those perceptions of the people with disabilities who competed were just completely different and through the roof. And I thought that was a pretty shocking comparison. So those are the kind of things that we have to work through and think about when we actively work on promoting disability sport.
Which, can I jump in just for a second, which is kind of interesting, because one of the words that you used, I think, is an interesting one in the idea of overcoming, because I think we as a society appreciate the myth of overcoming. There is a problem and you ever overcame it and it's never a problem again. But then, Michael, as you talked about it, it's the getting on buses, it's getting sponsors, it's getting around, it's doing this. It's like, you know, people say to me, well, you overcame being in a wheelchair. I'm like, nope, I'm pretty sure. Like, I will wake up tomorrow and I will still be in a wheelchair. But I think it's one of the hardest things that we do to ourselves as human beings is want to think that there's a magic pill kind of thing, that whatever ails us, we can take it and we're done. And it's not. It's a struggle every single day. And the beauty of the struggle is, one, it's what connects us as human beings. We are all going to struggle. And I think the people who are most successful are the ones who struggle better and longer oftentimes than the rest of us. But it's also the struggle is the thing that gives us that endorphin rush. You know, I mean, we're the reward that we get for struggling is that chemical release that says, hey, you did a good job. And so this idea of, you know, you overcame it all. And it's like, I mean, I think that that's one of the craziest myths that we have to confront as a society, because it sets us up for failure. Like, oh, I didn't overcome everything, so I'm a failure. It's like, no, you didn't overcome everything, so you're human. So let's go see what you can do again tomorrow.
I think the media does a great job of setting us up for that. I think that is the storyline of almost every single sport movie that's ever been made. Yeah. It's just, you know, you overcame it. You were screamed at. You became a great athlete. And you got out of the hood, or you got out of, you know, whatever was challenging you at the moment, and now life is good.
And every memoir that's been written, right? I mean, they're all written from what I call the top of the mountain. So it makes every single thing that happened along the way make sense, because you got to the top. But what happened afterwards, you know?
Yeah, right. he rolled all the way down the mountain.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking, right? There's no inspirational book or memoir then that is, well, I mean, it's much harder to point to the ones that are written from the bottom while they're written at the bottom.
Exactly. No, it's true. It's true. I mean, it's the story that we want to get, right? There's a happily ever after part of it. But it also, I mean, if you sort of look at the hero's journey kind of thing, I mean, you are going to go through that effective, like, near death kind of experience, right? I mean, that's part of the progression before you finally realize. And so sometimes we don't necessarily give it as much due as it might deserve.
It's interesting, because I think media is actually shifting a little bit. Talking about this, I started to realize, you know, there's shows that are coming out where everything goes wrong and it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And I wonder if reality TV is actually becoming a little more real.
I just talked to I was at an event this week, and there was a woman there who is a TikTok woman who had millions of followers, and I don't really completely understand it. And so I had to ask her, like, how did this happen? What did you do? And she said, I'm a young mom with little kids and I have a junk room. And I showed photos of my, like, the real life, not like, look at how my life is absolutely perfect and everything's in the right place and everything. And that got her millions of viewers. So maybe your point is exactly true.
I mean, that's the media too. The media, right? Narrative in sport is they popularize heroes in sport teams. I mean, that's part of the playbook for sports media, is to make, you know, right now, Aaron Judge, right? And hitting home runs is you know, the highest thing. And so they're going to keep making that, because popularizing individuals is a lot easier than a whole team or an area or something like that.
And again, I would just say that, what did Aaron Judge do? And do we understand what that means? Do we understand its historical context? And that's really valuable, because we have a frame of reference, right? And I think athletes with disabilities have an obligation to give a frame of reference, and hopefully the media has an idea to a responsibility to present a frame of reference when it comes to disability, because I think that that lack of frame of reference is one of the reasons we often kind of feed into simplistic narratives about disability, right? Oh, well, this person's really amazing. Well, do you know what they really accomplished? Whereas in Aaron Judge, it's very clear that's a record that yep. person, that's meaningful.
And in Aaron Judge camp, right? Anybody that played, you know, or grew up, I think, you know, you know, my day, or maybe y'all's day too, knows baseball a little bit and knows a little bit about Babe Ruth and Roger Maris and other home run records and then the steroids filled, you know, 2000s. But I think that's probably part of the enduring problem. Like I don't know any disability adaptive athletics Paralympic records. I know that climbing Mount Kilimanjaro was impressive, but I can't tell you how fast somebody should do it or what the average time is.
Or even what it should feel like. I mean, I will say that another thing we've noticed with what we've done with the study is when you give people a tactile experience of participating, you put someone in a chair, you have them do it, and we actually go through the process. We'll actually like strap them down different positions to sort of do our best to simulate, here's what a T4 feels like, here's what a C7 is going to do, here's how your hand's going to function, here's a device that's going to make your hand feel like this. Giving people a frame of reference that's tactile, that's memorable, that actually makes people have more genuine respect, more meaningful respect, because they have a frame of reference for it. I mean, I think that's really crucial versus just an observational experience.
Michael, is there a way to explain the different levels? I'm sure it's a much longer conversation, but is there a way to just kind of summarize a little bit for us so that we can?
Sure. A couple of thoughts. First of all, just for any of the listeners, the higher your injury level is, if you're a traditional spinal cord injury, not all disabilities participating in sports or spinal cord injuries, but it's a nice frame of reference because it's one of the larger populations, meaning that you have less physiological function because higher up your spinal cord, you have impairment. You're going to be able to engage with less muscle groups. You may not be able to lean over. You may not be able to stretch. You may not be able to use your hands normally. And we actually noticed that sports, there's broadly speaking, there's a spectrum, but there's broadly two approaches to how disability sports are actively looking to promote and manage disability sport. Some sports have very complex classification systems, and those allow for athletes with similar disabilities to compete against one another. And what that allows for is an equitable playing field where athletes are facing similar types of disabilities, and people are being judged sort of compared to people with same physiological functions. Other sports like wheelchair tennis have gone the complete other route where they actually have minimal classifications. And what we've actually seen is those sports with less classifications. In wheelchair tennis, it's basically, are you a quadriplegic or are you anything else? So you could be missing two toes. You can have a T10 injury. You could have a permanent knee injury. You can ambulate every day, but maybe you don't use a wheelchair to get around. Of the top 30 players in the world in wheelchair tennis, only two don't walk every day. So the disabilities that are visible in wheelchair tennis are really minimal. And the downside is it is not an equitable playing field for different types of disabilities. But the upside is for spectators, for consumers, it's really easy to digest because it's like, oh, it's tennis, but sitting down. And they don't have to understand, why does that person look that much more disabled? Why are they not competing against each other? How does this work? And it's much more digestible. So wheelchair tennis is one of the few sports that multiple athletes can make a real serious living at. And it's because they have decided to completely eschew classification in large measure, where other sports with complex classification systems really struggle. I had a colleague who was like, man, this was years ago. And he was like, I saw the sign that said, come see the fastest, you know, athlete with a disability in the world. And I thought I was going to see Oscar Pistorius, and it was a blind guy. And I didn't know who it was. And it was very confusing for me, right? Because there's so many classifications. There's so many types of categories of disabilities. So there is definitely sort of the digestibleness of the sport. How easy is it for you to digest is going to be relevant to probably how easy it is to sort of sell to sponsors, to spectators. But the type of everyone's disability, if they're just sitting down in a wheelchair or they're just blind, they're not all the same, I guess.
And Brian, to your point about records too, it's kind of interesting, just piggybacking on this, because sometimes it is a contextual thing. You have to find the context to be able to comprehend it. So for instance, like the wheelchair, the paraplegic wheelchair marathon record is 1 hour, 17 minutes and 47 seconds. So a couple of different contexts there. Back in 1954, Bannister broke the 4 minute mile, right? 4 minute mile, kind of a big deal. 3 minute miles for a marathon would be 1:18:36. So this is sub 3 minute miles for 26.2 miles. Yeah. Or a greater count is the runners, the fastest male runners, are doing whatever they can to try to break the 2 hour barrier, right? This still means that the fastest wheelchair athlete could finish, go back to his hotel, take a shower, grab a bite to eat, and watch the runners finish.
Yep. Thank you for that one. Because now I'm thinking about, I do a little loop on my bike. That's an 8 mile loop. And I sometimes it takes me like 40 minutes or something like that. And I when I get done, I go, oh my gosh, I'm biking slower than marathon runners. And now I'm thinking I'm biking slower than the wheelchair record as well in a marathon. Much slower than that too. And I'm sitting there now going, how the hell is somebody then pushing around in a chair that fast? Like that doesn't, right? It doesn't make sense. And then you go, you know, at the elite levels, elite athletes are special, man. Like through genetics, through work ethic, however the talent is developed. And we won't go down that road, but damn, that's impressive now.
Yeah.
And it's not just the technology by any means. It's not, it ain't that. Yeah.
I think we can all get together and boo Brian, can't we?
There you go. Please.
I've got a question for you guys to stretch your minds a little bit. In looking with this gender situation where things are changing, things are no longer, you know, male and female, how do we look at sport? What can we learn from how you were explaining the different categories and levels? Michael, how can we look at that and kind of reconstruct the way sport is done by gender?
Oh man, I feel like this is a better Dr. Garrity question. This is his wheelhouse.
I love throwing curveballs. There you go.
Sure. I would say that I do feel like the way that an athlete with a disability perceives disability may be very different than a person without a disability, because we're looking at different factors, right? We're looking at what muscle groups are contracting. We're looking at, oh, they have a lot of function. We often equate that with athleticism, sometimes wrongly, sometimes rightly. We look at can an individual sweat? Do they have blood pressure control stimulation? Those things are all factors that sort of play into how an athlete with a disability may see another athlete with a disability and how they conceptualize it. You will often hear people say tongue in cheek, oh, that guy's not disabled or not very disabled, or, you know, those discussions happen in this community, right? And it's almost like a compliment and almost like an insult, but more like a compliment. I think that there's a community that has a unique communication about that. Do you have any thoughts, Chris?
It's a really interesting question. And you've definitely opened up a whole can of worms potentially in the direction where we can go, which I think was entirely intended, I guess, is what I was trying to say. But it's interesting. And Michael, you started in a little bit of a context that I can kind of build on, in that, like, I was talking to a friend of mine who was a mono skier with me on the ski team, who was 5'1". 90 pounds, but she actually had, you know, she was an LW11. So she had like full stomach and full back. So in some ways I was, you know, 145 pounds and 6 feet tall, but in some ways she was actually effectively stronger than I was, because she had that core muscle group that was so important for what we were doing as skiers. So just to provide a little bit of a context, it can, you know, because gender in some ways we go, oh, well, okay, male means that you're stronger, but in some ways this can, you know, it can be completely separate or completely reversed. But I mean, it's a really interesting question. And so I'm going to leave it right there, because I think you intended us to go further than that. And I'm comfortable so far.
May's wanted us to fix it. Like, fix it. What's the problem? What's the problem?
What's Let's the answer?
That's great. I mean, I give you credit too, Mayor. I mean, I think that's a fantastic way of, right? A lot of times too, right? And Mike and I will talk about this academically. We try to draw in, you're pulling from somewhere else to understand your own context, you know, and we can go back and forth, but now we're saying, all right, what have we learned in this context that we can apply elsewhere too, to be more inclusive, to be more active, to be more encouraging and help people in their humanity and help society with it. And it's fantastic.
And it's interesting. I mean, sort of the context again, right? I mean, there are some places where there might well be an advantage. I mean, this is sort of back to Oscar Pistorius. This was the whole legal argument, right? Did he have an advantage by virtue of his legs? And they limited how high his legs were, which was really interesting, because he did letter of the law and then came to the Paralympics and ran the 200 in the Paralympics. And Oliveira from Brazil, on longer legs, went blowing by Oscar, who is the guy who had been in the public eye and seen as sort of the quintessential representation of this group. I'd love to see, you know, like a double amputee who found on a skateboard his whole life get into luge. You know, you look at a sport like that, where maybe this is like, I mean, you've just adapted to a particular sport, and your strength to weight ratio for that start just blows people away. You know, and without a prosthetic, without any question, it's like, no, I'm just missing legs. You know, because I mean, how cool is that as a compliment? It's like, oh no, sorry, your disability is giving you an advantage. You can't play with us. I mean, there's that happened in the German long jumping, where there was a German long jumper, a prosthetic, below the knee amputee, but they didn't let him jump because he was out jumping the Olympians, and actually in the Paralympics out jumped the gold medal. I'm pretty sure out jumped the gold medal distance for the Olympics.
That's when you're going to hear the able-bodied people boo, by the way.
I always said they'll say you're inspirational until you beat them, and then they'll say that you have an unfair advantage.
There you go.
But, all right, so I'll answer this question by asking a question and make you guys uncomfortable, because it'll be more fun that way. And then I'll give you my thoughts. If I were to ask you, what is a disability? How would you define it? What would you say, Meg?
Well, I would say it's something that is not in the realm of perceived normalcy.
Well, I mean, Brian's bolder than us, but we wouldn't probably define that as disabled, right?
Depending on what you're doing, there are disabilities. For example, I'm very dyslexic, and I have a lot, very high ADHD, if you hadn't noticed already. But you know, there are times when that doesn't matter at all. And there are other times when, you know, a great book came out that I wanted to read, but it wasn't available, you know, audio or, you know, thank goodness for Kindle and the computer reading to me. But there are things I couldn't do before that now I can do because I'm able to read. And so there are disabilities, but there are things that they're not disabilities all the time.
I think you're really close. So if you were asking for like legal interpretation, it's like one or more life skills that are impacted, talking, walking, eating, breathing, sleeping. But I would say that it's an environmental limitation. If an environment is modified or accommodated for, that disability becomes nullified or potentially, you know, advantageous, right? If you walked into a classroom and you were given a test and the room was pitch black and the test was in Braille, you would probably be very uncomfortable, but someone with visual impairment might be very comfortable with that. That environmental context is really relevant, right? When I teach a class, my students have to pretend like my jokes are funny. They have to pay attention. I'm not very disabled in that context, right? But when I do an international trip to Bangladesh, I feel much more disabled because of just barriers that exist, right? And so I do think that if we conceptualize disabilities as environmental limitations, and then we work on addressing that environment, a lot of these questions sort of take care of themselves.
It's interesting. I'm willing to take that as well. And you will see a common theme with me in that I see this in a more general terms, in terms of disability is that which gets in between us and what we want to do. And you know, I mean, we're looking at it. I mean, you're looking at it in more legal kinds of terms, but I like to be able to bring everybody into a similar kind of context in that, you know, there are things that get between us and sometimes we have to find a strategy to surmount that, whether it's an audiobook, whether it's something else. I mean, Brian, I think in some ways having no hair is probably a whole lot lower maintenance though, too. I mean, you can get up first thing in the morning and it's like, did he shower? Did he not? I mean, unless it's really close to you, nobody really knows.
The answer is nope.
Yeah.
I did not. And I've been doing this since before you hopped on, Chris. I was saying I've been shaving my heads with clippers at least since middle school because I hated taking care of my hair. So,
and back then it was probably not.
So that might be an issue.
By the way, you know, too, the folks are just going to listen. Chris has tremendous hair too. Like,
yeah. We're all jealous of your hair.
That's like George Clooney hair right there. He was just on the coat. I mean, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
Silver Fox over there. Yeah. Well, Mike, you know, I see you too, but.
Well, one of the things I was getting to get away from hair here.
He's running his hand. He's rubbing his hands through. Yes.
Power suggestion.
So one of the things I was interested in is, Michael, you were talking about where there's less kind of regulations with tennis versus ones that have a lot more. And I'm assuming that some of that has to do with the type of sport and the type of advantages or disadvantages in the sport. Because obviously when you compete, whether, you know, no matter how you're competing, you want it to be equitable.
I would love to tell you that that's the truth, but I do think sports have made some very strategic decisions on the marketability and branding questions. And so the answer to that is, I would say that if you asked the governing body of tennis, which is the wheelchair tennis governing body is tennis, they'll probably say, you know, there are, everyone's welcome to play, but the reality is some players are taller, some players are bigger, some players are stronger, and some players are more or less disabled. And so they're not particularly interested in creating numerous disability categories. They're very conscious that it is a branding decision that they can sell wheelchair tennis in a clean package where able-bodied consumers who love tennis can say, oh, this looks just like what I know, right? And it's been very successful. The winner of Wimbledon, I think, is getting over $180,000 this year in the wheelchair division alone just for that one tournament. You know, week's worth of work, that's not so bad. And so they've been able to create some opportunities for athletes with disabilities that other sports have not because they've focused on the packaging. And that's maybe made their sport more visible in some ways. It's also maybe motivated individuals with certain disabilities to matriculate to other sports. I think that it's a conscious discussion that's occurring in many disability sports is how inclusive, how marketable is this going to be? How much are we going to take disability into the equation? And if you look at the sports that sort of have the longest, oldest legacy in disability sports, they have very complex classification systems because that was not a discussion in the early stages. It was like, how are we going to sell this? It was very much, how do we create a playing field that provides opportunity for people with different disabilities to compete against people with similar disabilities? And that isn't necessarily a discussion with a number of sports that exist currently. There's not a right answer. There's not a wrong answer. There's just, what's your purpose? Is your purpose to create an equitable playing field? Is your purpose to create a marketable product?
So what would you like listeners to know then about including, you know, fans and managers about increasing the consumption?
I think have a rooting interest. Develop an emotional connection, right? Invite your friends, have a beer, put $5 on it. You know, make it a little more real, right? If you can go, yes, wow, that's what I'm talking about, or what are you doing? That will be what respects the sport the most, what respects the athlete the most, and I think what makes you want to come back again, right? and it's going to make your experience better, right? We know that things like consuming sports with friends, having close competition, having emotional ties to sports, those things are what make people consume over and over and over again, right? It creates a level of attachment, right? And so don't just go to say that you went. Don't just go to say this was cool. Go for the purpose of consuming sport. And when you sell it, you know, try to nudge people into cheering. I think that's really crucial.
Coming from the context of doing color commentary, it's both a challenge and an opportunity, right? Working on the Paralympic side and working on the sports side in general, because the more we understand about sport, the more ability we have to appreciate what's happening. And so that's, I feel like that's my responsibility in the booth, is to give people a similar appreciation to the appreciation that I have for that sport. You know, I'm there as a supposed expert, right? So that's so the intention is to be able to do that within the Paralympic context. It is trying to figure out what makes a great performance and why a performance is great. And even, you know, I mean, there are some sports, like even just talking to, you know, I was talking to some of the amputee high jumpers, and we watch high jumping. And we think about it and we go, okay, well, that's pretty impressive. But I was talking to one of the guys and I said, so you would be able to like jump over like the average door. And he said, oh yeah, like the average door, you know, you've got like a 7 foot, you know, it's like, or six and a half feet or whatever I think it is. And it's like, yeah, I would be able to jump over the average door. And so then you kind of go, well, the door, okay, like, wow, like, hold on, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And I think that's the challenge. But if we can find a way to be able to appreciate sport and go, oh wow, because the people who do it really well make it look really easy. And that's one of the biggest problems, is they make it look really easy. You know, I mean, Brian, you're talking about, you know, riding your bike and people, and then you watch these guys in the Tour de France who are going up ridiculous hills considerably faster than you're going downhill oftentimes. And you're going, how are they? I recognize that they are human and that I am human. And how are they doing that? So I think it's disability sport, but at the same time, it's sport being able to appreciate somebody for the way that they've been able to perfect something.
Well, that's great. We can't thank you both enough. Hopefully we can have you back on, because it sounds like we have a lot more to talk about, and a lot more information needs to get out there. I love the idea of providing more context so that you understand it more. I mean, I certainly have come a long way just in this 1 hour. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Make sure to leave us a 5-star review and hit the follow button, because there's more sport knowledge on the way. If you're interested in more information or want to engage in further conversation about these and other issues in sport, visit our website at spknmedia.com. To stay updated on all things SPKN, follow us on social media at SPKNmedia or email us at team@spknmedia.com, and we'll be happy to welcome you to the SPKN community.